Shall we talk first, though, about how we dress? We have always taken fashion very seriously. From English history, for example, here's a short excerpt from the book we'll discuss.
From the Times of London, January 16th, 1797. John Hetherington, haberdasher of the Strand, was arraigned on a charge of breach of the peace and inciting to riot, and required to post bond in the amount of £500 for the following offence. It was in evidence that Mr. Hetherington appeared on the public highway wearing upon his head what he called a silk hat, which was offered into evidence, a tall structure having a shining lustre and calculated to frighten timid people. As a matter of fact, officers of the Crown stated that several women fainted at the unusual sight, while children screamed, dogs yelped, and a young man was thrown down by the crowd which had collected and had his right arm broken. For these reasons, the defendant was seized by the guards and taken before the Lord Mayor.
And quite rightly, what was he thinking? From top hats to tattoos, from flappers to wrappers, Richard Thompson Ford has written Dress Codes, How the Laws of Fashion Made History. He's a law professor, which wouldn't seem to qualify him for this, but it has. Richard Thompson Ford is with the Stanford Law School. He's written about law, social and cultural issues and race relations for the New York Times and the Washington Post. He appears on some well-known US talk shows. He is the previous author of The Race Card and Rights Gone Wrong, How Law Corrupts the Struggle for Equality. He teaches civil rights and anti-discrimination, basically, and he lives in San Francisco. Professor Richard Ford, hello to you.
Hi.
Getting dressed will never be the same again after reading your book. I saw the headline in the Washington Post, and I've forgotten what they said in the review, but it was very complimentary. That's right, actually. Getting dressed, it'll never be the same again for me either. And I suppose in writing the book, it's made you think a lot more about the whole question.
Yes, it absolutely has.
Essentially, fashion has become paramount, although, of course, it always made a statement right through history, but paramount with the emergence of the modern individual. And I guess I could start this way. The word fashion changed from its former meaning, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I define fashion in the book as any clothing that's socially expressive. And many historians, I follow many historians in dating the birth of fashion to sometime in the late Middle Ages or the early Renaissance. And this was a moment when clothing became more expressive, in part because of a change in technology, the spread of tailoring, which allowed clothing to be form-fitting, but also allowed it to be somewhat sculptural. And so it had the effect of kind of re-sculpting the body. And this was in sharp distinction to the largely draped clothing that was worn in the ancient world.
And that, in hindsight, is so obvious and so important, but we don't often, at least I haven't, I've never thought about that, but it just makes so much sense. How do you dress for Stanford? I mean, you look very sartorial in one photo. You've got a, just to describe to listeners, you've got a blue shirt, no tie, blue handkerchief from the looks of it, tucked into the top front pocket of a darker blue suit jacket, kind of light green trousers and nice brown boots. So do you dress pretty smartly all the time?
I often do, I'd say. I'm interested in clothes. I guess I'm a little bit of a clothes horse. And so, I mean, I do enjoy it. And I also think it's important in my role as a professor to dress in, you know, a somewhat more, I guess, formal or refined way than the typical college student. And that's for, you know, many reasons that I could get into, but it has to do with my race and my position as an African American in a largely white institution. And, you know, but it also just has to do with what I feel comfortable in.
You also talk in your book, though, although, as you say, we needn't get into it, that that's the way many academics studiously don't dress.
Yes.
You are a clothes horse. There's a photo of you also in one of your online talks and in the book of you and your daughter, Ella, that you submitted to Esquire magazine's Best Dressed contest in 2009. But you didn't win.
No, I didn't win. Ella had just been born, and so we were, as many young parents are, overwhelmed, and being glamorous or fashionable was really kind of the last thing on our minds. But I thought it would be fun as a break from the rigors of parenting to enter the contest, and I got to the semifinals, but I didn't win. And, the reason I didn't win was because I blew the interview. There was a interview portion of the competition, and they asked questions about why I dressed the way I did and who my fashion influences were and things like this. And I really couldn't answer those questions. I hadn't thought about it. I kind of dressed the way I did intuitively. And I thought afterwards, this is pathetic. I'm someone who's paid to explain difficult concepts to people for a living. That's what professors do. But I couldn't for the life of me explain this to this interviewer from Esquire. So one of the reasons I started to research the book was because I thought I owed myself a better answer than the one I was able to get.
Yeah, that's an interesting reason for writing a book. Well, but you got onto this topic through the law as well, because you couldn't help noticing dress codes in society. They're argued about. People draw lines in fashion. They take umbrage about what is acceptable and what's not. And we still do that wholesale today.
Yes, absolutely. In the study of these bodies of law, there were a surprising number of cases that involved dress codes. Dress codes that prohibit hairstyles worn by African-American women, like braids, all braided styles. Or dress codes that require women and only women to wear makeup or to tease their hair or to wear high-heeled shoes. There are dress codes that, every year there are disputes around dress codes at graduation and high school graduations and proms, where a school dress code will prevent somebody from participating. But also the strength of the claims, the fact that people will risk a good job or an employer will risk a good employee over a dress code, made me think that there's a lot involved, deep stakes, that we often don't acknowledge in how people present themselves to the world through dress.
And that applies especially to women. So I'll get back to the topic of what women wear. But your father believed that clothes make the man, and you quote Hamlet, "The apparel oft proclaims the man." Tell us a wee bit about your dad.
Yes, well, my father was born in the Jim Crow segregated South. He was born in Birmingham, Alabama. He went to a historically black college and studied, as well as his profession, he studied as a tailor. So he learned about clothing, and this was at a time when, in historically black colleges, people would study a trade as well as a profession in case racial barriers kept them from pursuing their professional ambitions. He was often the only black man in environments where he worked or where he circulated socially. And so for him, refined clothing was an important part of, I guess you could say, a claim of dignity and self-respect.
Which is very important and understandable why he thought that way and why you have inherited that care for clothing. But you must have wondered this. I mean, just in passing, why do some people look smartly dressed when others, and I'm probably talking about myself here to be truthful, do not, even with quite good clothes on? There are simply clothes horses like your good self and clothes I don't know, mules, donkeys, the rest of us.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot depends on how interested one is in fashion and its subtleties, because it takes a while to figure out what looks good on an individual and what one's comfortable in. There are also many people who are in a position in society where they don't really have to care as much about how they dress, because they have other status advantages, if you will.
Yes. I love the photo you have in your book of the trunk hose that men used to wear in Tudor England, people have probably seen them in some, at some point, those ballooning pants that didn't go far down the leg. And the multiplicity of laws and ordinances in Elizabeth I's time over what you could and could not wear. And I mentioned this earlier, we've talked about it a bit already, because it gets to the heart of your thesis that fashion is about assertion of self. And that is also about power and threats to the existing social order. And that still applies today as well, Richard.
Yes. Queen Elizabeth, for instance, was quite a master of fashion, and she used the power of fashion in order to present herself in an almost otherworldly way. It was as if she had a magnificence that, you know, your typical mortal couldn't approach. And the clothing, in the way that it really reshaped her body, was quite remarked upon at the time. Now, it was important as a matter of statecraft for her to monopolize that type of fashion and to control who could use it in order to reinforce political power in the existing social hierarchy. And so it was very important that commoners, the butcher's wife, for instance, not be allowed to wear clothing of that sort. And as a consequence, they passed multiple laws in order to ensure that people's clothing corresponded to their social status. These were called acts of apparel in Tudor England. But throughout Europe, there were versions of these types of laws that regulated clothing according to social hierarchy and social status.
And we may laugh at that, but in our own way, we are just as constrained today. Well, perhaps not as legally constrained, but you know what I'm saying. We are still highly aware of what club we can get into and what clubs will stop us getting into them because of what we wear.
Yes, no, I think that's absolutely right. It's in a whole host of stated and unstated ways. I think one of the things that's more striking about our contemporary moment is that most of the rules that establish how clothing signifies social status are unstated. And increasingly, we don't have dress codes that are formal or enforced. But nevertheless, the way people dress allows us to sort people according to social status quite effectively. And you see that even in environments where on the surface, it would seem, there are no rules.
Yes, on the surface. You sometimes hear men say nowadays that in Tudor times, or you say through the 17th century as well, most of it, men dressed in pretty fancy ways and they wore makeup and such. And then everything for men became minimal. And in the 18th century, you say, we were beginning to see the incipient arrival of the dreaded business suit. Why?
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely right. So for hundreds of years, men dressed in this very flamboyant fashion, and this was the way that power was expressed. If you look at a picture of Henry VIII, if you look at pictures of men in the Renaissance, and indeed, the most striking innovations in fashion started with male fashion, masculine fashion, and women kind of followed. By the 19th century, it had dramatically changed so that masculine power was signified through streamlined clothing. As you say, the precursors to the business suit, lack of adornment, and it expressed a new ethos, an ethos of practicality, an ethos of reason, an ethos to some extent of social equality, so a rejection of aristocracy, an ethos of industriousness.
And you call this the great masculine renunciation. But
yes.
But why? Because it was a masterstroke also of paternalism, wasn't it?
It was. And women's fashion continued to be quite opulent, quite expressive, quite cumbersome. Women were decorative, and they were not seen as capable and competent and able to exercise those kinds of virtues that were becoming more and more important in the modern world. The distance between the power and influence of men and women actually increased in a period of time in which in other areas things were becoming more equal.
So men were actually saying, we're in charge and we're going to dress in a no-nonsense way, just to make that point that we're not concerned with the fripperies of life. We're tackling the big stuff.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
And yet in Elizabethan England, for example, to use that example again, although your book traverses much more geography than that, when men were trying to be all fancy pants in that era, they still by and large controlled everything.
Yes.
Still. So it's still a slight yes. puzzle why modern men went for dull attire. I mean, you've explained the reason, but it's still a slight head scratcher.
The value system changed, and that's the important part. So that in Tudor England, high status was about nobility, but things like productive work were considered to be beneath the nobleman or the aristocrat. As the Enlightenment begins to take hold, values like industriousness and practicality, the work ethic, begin to take hold as well, and those now are the virtues that are associated with high status and power. And so the clothing changes in order to reflect that. You see similar things happening in other areas of the expressive arts, like, for instance, architecture, where, you know, Baroque styles are giving way to much more streamlined styles there. So the men are on the cutting edge, and the women are, in some sense, kind of stuck with anachronistic styles, styles that really reflect the values of the past. Men were no longer fashion conscious, they were just well dressed, which was practical and sensible. But the wives were fashion conscious and spent lots of money on clothing, which reflected well on the man and his wealth, but also without him having to embrace those old, now kind of antiquated values of opulence and display.
Professor Richard Thompson Ford is with us. Dress codes, how the laws of fashion made history. And to take a long jump through history from then on, early feminists saw all this. They saw the restrictions their clothing automatically imposed. Corsets, narrow-toed shoes, heavily weighted skirts, crinolines, crinolettes. They were quick to identify how they were constrained.
Yes, they were. And there were a number of dress reform movements that sought to change women's clothing to make it more streamlined, more practical, easier to wear. And it caught on for a short period of time. Bloomers kind of swept the nation, became a fashion trend in the mid-1800s. But they were ridiculed out of existence. Amelia Bloomer herself eventually gave up on the bloomers and decided that the crinoline, which, you know, that cage skirt was progress enough because at least it wasn't the heavy layers of skirts that women used to have to wear. But effectively, that movement for women's reform was beaten back.
Women's reform was literally weighed down, wasn't it? It's fascinating.
Yes.
Why was bifurcation such a powerful statement? The outline of legs. I was really,
yes.
I thought, is it somehow because striding is a statement itself? And if you aren't seen to stride, you know, i.e. walk, you're not in the competitive human race somehow, or am I being fanciful?
Well, I mean, one thing that we can certainly say is that draped clothing that we talked about at the beginning of the show, that was common to both sexes before the birth of fashion, women retained that below the waist. So when women started to adopt aspects of masculine fashion, the tailoring could come in, but only above the waist. Women were draped below the waist in skirts until the early 20th century, and a woman in tailored clothing below the waist, trousers, was a scandal. A woman wearing trousers was called a bifurcated woman, and it was seen as quite scandalous and actually as a sexual fetish. In the book, I have a photograph of a magazine cover of women wearing trousers, and if you look at it today, they're, you know, loose-fitting men's trousers. There's nothing racy about them. They're not tight. They're not see-through. But nevertheless, this was considered to be quite a scandalous sexual fetish and, you know, sold as such on the covers of a racy magazine. One reason this was seen as so scandalous was that women wearing aspects of masculine clothing had long been seen as a transgression of feminine modesty. For many, many centuries, a woman dressed in masculine clothing was presumed to be either a prostitute or up to no good in some, you know, in some sense of sexual transgression. In the early Middle Ages, they were described as committing sexual misrule. But later, all the way into the early 20th centuries, women dressed in masculine clothing were seen as indecently dressed.
Yes. And there's a lot of that in your book, the history of all that. Okay, so it made them decorative, their clothing. It limited their movement, literally, and their opportunities. But the interesting thing is that, of course, women internalized all this, and many of them just wouldn't have been comfortable in easier clothes. Just as I, you know, being heterosexual and not Scottish, would not be comfortable in a dress. You know, we just accepted all this.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the important things to emphasize about the power of fashion is that it's not just a question of an individual using fashion to express something, but it's also that fashion changes one's relationship to one's own body. One can feel more comfortable wearing clothing that's understood to be suitable for their body and their occasion. And yes, absolutely, most people internalize the fashion norms of the time, and they don't feel comfortable. They would feel silly. They would feel immodest. They would feel out of place wearing clothing that doesn't correspond to social norms. And that's why these dress reform movements were so fraught and so difficult to get off the ground, because it was easy to ridicule someone in the way that we always ridicule people who seem to be inappropriately dressed.
Yeah. From your book, interesting tidbits. And speaking of the clothes making the man, people who wore a white lab coat or dressed up for a job interview, either, exhibited better abstract reasoning than people of comparable intelligence wearing jeans and t-shirts.
Yes. The psychological power of clothing is fascinating. So that study demonstrates that clothing affects us. Again, we don't just use it as a tool, but it also has a profound effect on how we feel about ourselves.
A fairly famous photo you use of people of color marching on Washington for civil rights in 1963. A lot of smart-looking African-American men in smart suits and ties. And the inference we took, and I'm sure you're right, we did infer this, was that this was respectability politics. But you say it wasn't.
Well, right, or that we should redefine respectability politics. Right now, there's a tendency to think that when we say respectability politics, it's people trying to ingratiate themselves to the power structure, trying to, you know, act respectable, sort of at the expense of people who may be socially, they're social inferiors in a social hierarchy. But that's not what was happening in the civil rights movement. Quite the opposite. Wearing this type of refined clothing was a powerful oppositional statement to racial hierarchy. Because if you look at the history of the relationship between race and attire, for generations, laws as well as social customs prohibited African Americans from dressing in refined clothing. There were laws on the books in the South in the 1700s. People condemning African Americans for dressing in fancy clothes and putting on airs. So in that context, and this continued, I should note, this continued after emancipation. Well-dressed black people were still subject to ridicule and, in many cases, violence. Violent mobs would chase well-dressed African Americans and strip their clothing from them in some instances. So this was seen as a threat to the social order. It was understood by everyone involved to be an assertion of status and a demand for dignity. And that's what's going on in the civil rights movement. That respectable dress was a way of saying we deserve the respect that this clothing signifies in our society.
But then later, we had everyone from Bill Cosby in a famous speech he gave, or infamous, depending on your point of view, but also Barack Obama, decrying dressing down among African Americans and suggesting that they should pull their pants up and take the hoodies off because previous generations of civil rights marches hadn't been battened and hit in the face with rocks to have social progress squandered like this.
That's right. And so there's a long, there's history in between the civil rights movement and the kind of controversies over sagging pants. And in one sense, you could describe, for instance, then Senator, now and later President Barack Obama, as suggesting that respectable and refined dress was an important part of the struggle for racial justice. I think that tension, or that kind of disagreement between one generation that sees respectable dress as the more conventional high status clothing in society, and a new generation that sees empowerment in creating new types of symbolism that in some sense are in opposition to the bourgeois mainstream, is one that we continue to see with respect to the kind of sagging pants controversies that you were talking about.
Yes, you say that in seeming to eschew dress codes, we in fact secretly insist on them. You list the absurd rules for attire at places like Royal Ascot. This is a marvellous list, which I won't have time to get into. But then you suggest, you know, the butt crack pants and the denim, what kind of denim to wear, and pins and piercing and tattoos, I suppose, you wear now when you're young, are just as much a code of belonging. It's the same with academia. It's the same with Silicon Valley.
Yes. The dressed down casual look of people in Silicon Valley is a type of dress code, and people who depart from it are punished, even while they're saying, we don't care about what anyone wears. We're above that.
So does the masculine renunciation still apply? I mean, we can all imagine what a business suit connotes, but the wearing of business suits is in decline, or maybe not in decline, but certainly reduced use. But we still have to be careful about how we present ourselves to suggest responsibility and maturity and manliness, if that's applicable, and an air of calm authority and so on. So what has replaced the suit? Nothing wholesale. I mean, I don't think I can look at my male colleagues and easily arrive at a simple description.
No, I think things have become much more complicated in that respect, because in one sense, the business suit has now been renounced itself. I do think we're still seeing a dynamic that's similar to that of the great masculine renunciation, but now it's the business suit that looks like opulent and practical, almost formal court dress. And that's been renounced by a new generation in favor of something that seems streamlined and practical, whether it's, you know, the hoodie sweatshirt or the gray t-shirt that we associate with Silicon Valley. There's all in high finance now, at least in the United States, there's a new kind of almost uniform. In fact, some have called it the Midtown uniform, but it's a button-down Oxford cloth shirt and a Patagonia fleece and a pair of khakis. And this Instagram page called Midtown Uniform has pictures of, you know, scores, dozens of men dressed in almost exactly the same clothing. Now, this has come about in a context in which the formal dress code has been repealed, and yet everyone feels the need to dress in this very similar fashion. And in academia as well, there is an ethos of how one should dress. And people who are dressed too fashionably won't be taken seriously. I think this is especially true for women, but it's also true to a lesser extent for men. So that new dress down ethos isn't indifference to fashion. It's actually a new form of dress code in which there are new rules. But these are rules that one has to figure out on their own. They're not written down anywhere.
So are we unconsciously subscribing to this, just as women may not have thought much about, or often about, being trapped in their heavily weighted clothes? I mean, I don't want the receptionist to think I've let myself go as I walk out of the lift into the office of a morning. But, you know, I don't think about it much. Do you think these people you've been describing think about it much?
I think sometimes they do, and then when one can settle into a uniform of a type, then they don't. So one piece of evidence that they do think about it sometimes is that very often people will ascribe some sort of significance to their clothing. So, for example, Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, you know, can famously always wears a gray t-shirt, except when he's going in front of the United States Congress. And that you might think that's somebody who doesn't think about it, but when asked, he says, he shows he's thought about it quite a lot. And he says, the reason I wear a gray t-shirt every day is because I don't want to waste time worrying about what I'm wearing. And if I were to spend time on trivial things like what I'm going to wear in the morning, I wouldn't be doing my job in order to make Facebook the best company it can be. Now, you know, in one sense, in saying I don't think about it, he's actually shown he's thought about it quite a lot there. And he's subscribed moral significance to the clothing that he's wearing. And that moral significance is something that carries over to other people. When Marissa Mayer, who's the CEO of Yahoo, was pictured on the cover of a magazine wearing a very fashionable dress, people said, look at that. She looks like she's going to a party or going on vacation while everyone else is working.
Have women freed themselves into a new kind of tyranny? Quoting from your book again, there are no ugly women, only lazy ones. Helena Rubinstein, the pressure is always on.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. One of the things that's just a consistent theme in the research that I conducted for the book was the way women are always caught in these catch-22 binds. So from very early on, they're expected to be modest. And that gets us back to the questions of the being draped below the waist and bifurcation and all that. Modest, but also expected to be decorative. And there's always room to criticize a woman's dress. Either she's too drab and boring and not feminine enough, or she's too sexy and therefore immodest and guilty of distracting or tempting men. And so women have been caught in this bind for quite a while. The women's dress reform movements were attempts to escape that bind, but in many cases, in escaping one aspect of it, only delivers the women all the more firmly into the other side of the double bind. And so that's been a real dilemma for women historically, and I do think it's still true today.
And we haven't got to the tyranny of the high-heeled shoe, but you do. That they improve the high heels, improve the look of a leg, but you say they also curtail the gait in a way that is directed straight at the male gaze.
Yes. And so, I mean, the history of the high heel shoe is quite striking because it begins, at least in Europe, as a masculine fashion, and it was derived from heeled shoes worn by Persian equestrians who really took certain European capitals by storm. They were quite exotic. They were quite virile. And those shoes were taken up by men. But over time, they, of course, became associated with femininity and women's fashion. And they do now suggest impracticality. And there's certainly been a lot written about people condemning high-heeled shoes, not just feminists, but also men who condemned high-heeled shoes in ways that were quite misogynistic in some cases, and condemned the women wearing them. And they do have this characteristic of suggesting a certain kind of vulnerability, but also suggesting power. So because they make the woman taller, and because it's so clear that they require skill and mastery, they can be a power statement.
Mm, yes. So much information on your book. Never wear a watch to a black tie occasion. I don't have a chance to ask you why, but that's in there. Interesting, the Highland kilt was rejected in favour of trousers by the elite among the Scottish clans. I never knew that. Provocative female clothing does not, you say, citing sociological studies, provocative dress on women does not increase the chances of a woman being sexually assaulted.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. A striking finding there. But one, when you think about it, makes sense. If you reflect on the feminist understanding that sexual assault is not a crime of passion or eroticism, but one of violence, then the violent criminal looks not for attractive victims, but for vulnerable ones.
Yeah.
And what the study suggested was that women dressed in provocative clothing looked assertive, not vulnerable, not easy victims, and therefore the potential assailant was less likely to target them and more likely to target a woman who looked meek and submissive.
Interesting that. You've got a chapter on recoding gender. You mention the trans blogs like She's a Gent and A Dapper Chick. I was fascinated, Richard, that a century ago it was recommended that boys wear pink and girls blue. And I thought I'd misread that sentence, and I read it again and it said the same thing.
Yes, no, that's absolutely right. The identification of pink with girls and boys with blue happened only in the mid-20th century, and earlier it was reversed. Pink was thought to be a strong masculine color, and light blue a delicate color more suitable for girls. And so, there's another example just demonstrating the kind of arbitrariness of our gender identifications. It changed based on, a matter of historical contingency.
And speaking of arbitrariness, my last question. Many people must get the feeling that fashion is so irrelevant a lot of the time, but we are all slaves to it, and there's not really escaping it.
Yes, I think that's right. It's one of the ways that we've come to define ourselves as modern individuals. Fashion is how we present ourselves, our bodies in the world, and it reflects our not only our individual sense of self, but also the way we think about our social interactions with others. In a sense, there's nothing that could be more indispensable, and because it's indispensable, it is inescapable.
Inescapable and surprisingly important. Great to talk to you. Thank you for the book and for your time.
Thank you.
Professor Richard Thompson Ford, the law professor from Stanford, and the book is called Dress Codes.